Welcome to the My Walk, My Way podcast.
They wanted to take away my darkness,
but that will take away my light.
They wanted to take away my darkness,
but I've learned to make it mine. I learned to love it over time.
I've learned to make my shadow shine.
I hope you're enjoying the My Walk, My Way podcast. If you are, make sure that you subscribe so you always know when a new episode is coming out, and leave us a review. It helps other people to find out about the podcast. If you'd like to keep the conversation going, please join us on our Facebook page, the My Walk, My Way community, where we talk more about the authors, about their endotypes, and about their stories. That's also where you can ask questions about your endotype. If you don't know yet what your endotype is, go to the My Walk, My Way website. Both links are in the show notes below. And take the simple 5-question assessment to find out what your endotype is, which author you're most like, and download the free resource guide that helps you understand more about how you work. It helps you start to move through fear so that you can do your walk your way. And if you're part of a book club, we invite you to make My Walk, My Way part of the books you consider this year. And we have included a book club guide on our website. In this episode of today's podcast, we're going to talk about frogs and getting boiled alive. Today, I am speaking with Keely Crook and her chapter, You Won't Boil Me Alive. I'm going to issue a little bit of a trigger warning here. Keely and I are going to talk about domestic violence. We are going to talk about emotional abuse, financial abuse, and violence inside of relationships, and specifically leaving them. From the perspective of, what do you do when you love someone, but their behavior is unacceptable? Their behavior is moving towards violence. Please join me for this episode of the podcast, where we talk about what it's like being in that space and leaving that space, having to deal with afterwards all the things people say, and answer some of the questions of, like, I didn't think it was that bad. Why didn't I know? He doesn't seem that awful. I hope you enjoy. Keely, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the podcast. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. So we're going to launch right into it, right into your chapter. You have a story that you share in your chapter about how to boil a frog alive. Can you tell us that fable or that story about how you boil a frog alive?
Yeah, it's not scientifically proven, just to be clear, right. But just so nobody thinks that, but it's the idea that things heat up slowly over time, that a frog being put in a pot of water that's, you know, like just a regular temperature, and then if you slowly heat that up, that the frog won't jump out of the pot, because it's sort of like getting the spa treatment, you know, it's slowly heating up, and oh, it's might getting a little bit hot in here, but at the end of it, it's too hot to withstand. And the frog, instead of jumping out, has acclimated to all of the temperatures. So then it boils alive, essentially. So that's the fable that my story is revolving around, how mm-hmm. in my relationship with my husband, that things didn't start out the way, you know, the way they ended up. If it would have started out, you know, with the things that were happening at the end, I wouldn't have endured that. But since things happened slowly over time, and, you know, more or less, I was just kind of left in a sense of confusion when these things would come up, but it wasn't anything significant. I would find myself making excuses for certain behaviors. Oh, he's having a bad day, or, you know, not, it just sort of you know, withstanding them, because in marriage, right, like nothing's perfect. And we sometimes put up with, you know, in the essence, I was putting up with more than I should have been putting up with, but I didn't really realize it at the time.
Yeah. That's the way, and that's why I love the fact that you used that story, that illustration, you know, having also been through similar experiences myself, and anybody who's been through a similar experience would likely say the exact same thing. If it started with those behaviors that it ended with, we would have been like, no way, no, you know,
mm-hmm.
no Absolutely. Problem. But it's that gradualism that happens inside a relationship. And that's the part that people, you know, who haven't experienced it don't understand. And so mm-hmm. today in the podcast, you know, like I'll probably ask you some questions about your experience and what would help people, what helped you get out. But the other thing that I want to talk about a little bit is those friends, family members, situations like that, where it's like, Cause they all of a sudden one day go, what do you mean? I didn't know. Or they're trying to be helpful and say helpful things that aren't always helpful in the moment. So from the perspective of those outsiders, you know, we who have been there maybe can share some tips.
Definitely. I think one thing to note is that with emotional abuse, it's not something that's done in front of other people. So no one else witnesses it. And that's part of the problem. That's why it's so insidious, is because, you know, when it's occurring to you, it's behind closed doors. And so many people don't either believe you or they see something totally different. They've known the person for years and they have never been treated that way. So why would you believe me when I'm saying all of a sudden that I'm getting put down on a regular basis and being screamed at in my face, and no one else has ever experienced that themselves from this individual? So who are you going to believe? You know, your own experience or what somebody else is telling you that you may not know as well? Or in my case, I had friends that knew me for years and had never seen that side of my partner and questioned me about it, which was, I think, the most unnerving part about it. And these are well-meaning friends, and they're just asking, like, maybe, you know, Keely, maybe you're just taking it the wrong way. And, you know, I can understand that, but this is how this happens to people who I struggle with saying the word victim, but people who have overcome these challenges in these relationships because of the fact that no one on the outside sees what's happening on the inside.
Right. The other saying or the other thing that often frequently comes up when people are trying to, when the outsiders, right, friends, family members are trying to make peace and understand, mm-hmm. that I've heard multiple times is, right, it takes two. It always takes two. And that's absolutely true that there are two people in the relationship for sure. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes that takes two means it has this element of, what did you do to provoke this? And that's just not always. And even I'm going to go a step further and say, that's not usually the case. Mm-hmm. Usually it is that there are two behaviors, but I found that for myself, my behavior was I put up with it for a really stinking long time, silently without them knowing. Mm-hmm. And that was my responsibility of the, you know, like that's why it continued for as long as it did. That's the, where I can see my, it takes two, like my part of the stuff happen. How do you react to that statement of, you know, taking two?
I think, yes, it takes two people to build a relationship. In some cases, it takes two people to destroy a relationship. But in my case, I was doing everything I could. I was researching things to try to make, you know, the relationship better, even recommended seeing a therapist and, you know, went to a therapist. And then there always comes to this point where, okay, is it me? You know, I had to Google things like, why is my husband, yelling at me all of the time? Like, is it, what am I doing? Am I the problem in the relationship? And I would actively seek out answers to these questions. And I think that's where, over time, after doing this for so long, I realized that I am doing everything I can in my power to try to make things better, but it's not working. So now I have to determine, am I really the problem? So right. If you're dealing with two people who are actively trying to solve a problem, then yes, it takes two. But when you're looking at, for like from my side of the story where I was actively pursuing, you know, trying to figure things out, well, he wasn't trying to figure things out because they were working fine for him as long as I didn't speak up about it or make any waves or try to shed some light on my unhappiness or what was going on in my psyche. You know, like, hey, you know, I noticed that when I bring problems up in a relationship, you know, in certain areas, when I try to bring them up very calmly, making sure that I'm not overreacting to things, walking on eggshells to try to, you know, come at it with, you know, from my heart, that approach did not work for me. When in a normal relationship, a healthy relationship, it would work perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, coming back to it takes two. Yeah, it takes two people to figure out your relationship too. You can't depend on just one person making the effort and the other one thinking that they don't need to make an effort.
Right. Absolutely. What were, if you can remember, what were some of the more beneficial things or helpful things, perspectives, things said from those outside of the relationship that either helped you to see and leave, or that were strengthening once you were out? Like, what should we say?
That's a tough one because, well, number one, when it's occurring in your relationship and it's behind closed doors and you're not sure of what your boundaries are and that anyone's even overstepping those and you're just taking stuff as it comes, like, for example, put downs, backhand compliments, criticizing, you know, yelling in your face. And then you're processing, you're so busy processing this stuff, you don't realize that there's a problem. Because I feel like it stems from somewhere in childhood where we are, in essence, at some point in our lives, taught that you're not allowed to have boundaries and that, you know, you are supposed to just put up with, you know, these terrible behaviors from people because adults in your life have either, you know, done things like that in the past or talked to you like that in the past that you've witnessed your own parents talking like that to each other, that you've normalized it. So it's really hard to understand it. You're left with this, in my case, I was left with this like feeling of confusion and anxiety tied together. Like I knew that there was something wrong, but couldn't really identify what it was and how to solve it. So when it comes to the other people, like you, I think that's part of the problem when you don't talk to other people about it, you know, they don't really have the opportunity to help guide you. And I think the other thing is that not a lot of people are really aware of verbal and emotional abuse because we've normalized it so much that when you try to talk about it, people try to normalize it for you. And even though they're well-meaning and they really are trying to help, it's just that the awareness has not really been out there until now. And I think it's really important that we start having these conversations because, you know, for example, physical abuse leaves scars or marks or bruises, but emotional abuse does not, but it hurts just the same. And I think that it's time we really bring that into the forefront, especially with social media. And I think with people, you know, treating each other really poorly, we see that even more and more, just how people speak to each other. It's really abusive online and we just tolerate it. And social media teaches us to continue tolerating it. And I think that that's not a good thing. But, you know, again, I think with, you know, in terms of other people, they have normalized it too. And they think that maybe you're overreacting. And it's hard because, you know, until you show people like emails or proof or like record something. I had to write situations down because I would go through like a sort of amnesia, you know, pretending that, oh, things are going to get better. He's just having a bad day. But then the pattern continues and they just never get, it never gets better.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's not all bad days. That's the thing. Right. Like there are some good days, and especially in front of other people, very often there are good days, good times, but having been someone who's experienced that too, those are almost harder times to deal with, right? Like to my experience was, right, in my relationship, we would be in one of these controversial things, right? We're trying to settle an issue and he didn't really like to compromise much. We're trying to settle an issue. We're trying to whatever. And we'd be in the car, right? Especially, and we get somewhere and that fast, he was a different person.
Yeah.
Or we go, right. We go on vacation and the entire time we were on vacation with family or friends or whatever. And he was like helpful and kind and a little bit the guy, like there was this glimmer of the guy that I knew. And then we would leave and get in the car to go home. And that fast it would shut off. And it got so like, I don't even want to go with you anymore. Like, I don't want to go with you on this visit. Because that seeing it and then having it taken away again.
Yeah.
Was so hard emotionally to deal with. And just... but those are things that other people don't see.
Right. Yeah. And my experience, I didn't write about this in the book, but you know, it was, we were in the car on a way to see one of my daughters. It was a school event where they had set up these displays for like a science project or something, and fighting in the car. And I finally said, okay, we're here. We need to stop this. This is just, I don't want to do this. And I got out of the car and he was still yelling at me outside of the car. And there was a lady behind us on the sidewalk. And I didn't even look at her. I just kept walking and he was continued to like speak very terrible to me all the way to the school door. And then all of a sudden it in a blink of an eye like that, we walked in the door and he was like all happy, like, oh, what's going on? And that I was still in a like this PTSD state where I'm a total in a state of shock and, you know, just trying to focus. I couldn't even focus. I walk in the door. I feel like I'm shaking. I'm like, what just happened? And he's acting completely normal. And right. I am still like, it takes me time to like get over that. And we were in the schoolroom and then I just sort of avoided him and walked around and just pretended to look at stuff. But I honestly, during that whole time, I don't even know what I saw. I couldn't even process what was going on around me because I was stuck in this state of shock. And then, you know, we left and, you know, as soon as we walk out the door, you know, he was nicer to me, but it was still, then I'm like in this feeling of untrust. Like, is it safe? Like I felt like I was not emotionally safe. Yeah.
Right. Well, and in my experience, moving through that for so many years, and I think mine probably started a lot more gradually than perhaps what yours did. And it was a lot of just little, you know, littler stuff. But it was never resolved, which caused a ton of frustration and a lot of anger for me, right? And so we would get to a place and I'm still super frustrated and angry. And I can't just shake that off. Like I don't have the switch. Mm-hmm. I don't have the switch that just shuts that off. And so people around me would sense I was an angry person. I was frustrated. I was short or curt. And then here's this happy, helpful, lovely partner that I have. Well, to them, who seems to be a challenge? I seemed like I was more of the challenge. Right. Right. You know, and so it just, there's a lot of false perception
Yeah.
To the outside world.
Well, and the other thing is that sometimes they're very good at triggering that in you as well. Oh, yeah. And they know like the precise times to trigger it in front of other people. So they look like they're the angel in the relationship. So it's, you know, there would be a constant, he would say constantly, if I would mention something that wasn't so good, like, okay, you know, I'm struggling to understand why we are fighting about this. He would say something like, well, everyone who knows me knows I'm a good guy. I'm a nice guy. Like, I don't know why you think that, you know, I would do anything like that. Or everyone knows me is stable and you're the one causing these problems. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I don't understand what's happening right now. Like, I feel like somebody's doing a Jedi mind trick on me.
Yep. Yeah.
Pretty logical person. Like, I'm not like this type of woman who loses her head and is, you know, there are things that trigger all of us. Let's be fair. You know,
sure.
Loses our tempers about things, but not over like nothing.
Right. I don't know. Well, and I think another contributing factor with your endotype being the contributor endotype, a big part of the contributor endotype is questioning whether or not they're doing enough or they're doing the right thing to be loved. There's almost this feeling like you have to earn it. Do you think that that played into kind of this interaction?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that that's true. I'm, you know, we all have different love languages. I think, I don't know. It depends mm-hmm. on, you know, what you believe or what you think is true. If that's proven, I don't know. But the thing is, for me, I'm definitely, if someone says they're going to do something like that, I want to be the one who follows through with that. Like mm-hmm. if I say I'm going to do something, am I perfect about that? No, there's things that are going to come up inevitably, but right. I would like to think that I'm the type of person who, when I say I'm going to do something, I show up on, you know, I show up, I do what I say I'm going to do, and people can trust that from me. But I think in this case, you know, you're right. Like, I'm so willing to like do stuff for people and show them that I'm trustworthy and that I'm a good person, that, you know, there are times that I, like in this relationship, I think starting out, you know, he would probably test me, you know, making sure that I would, you know, I wasn't too, that my boundaries weren't too firm, I think, you know, mm-hmm. and maybe that's like subconscious. I don't know that he like went out of his way to do that, but, you know, definitely there are times I felt like, oh my gosh, like, am I doing something wrong? Like, you know, I questioned things. And I think in my book, like there's one example I gave about, you know, he was looking through my mail or something and saw like a student loan I had and it, you know, questioning like my financial fitness and I was fine, you know, but then I start questioning, is this enough? Like, am I doing something wrong? Because it triggered that in me, you know, thinking, oh, maybe I, you know, even though I didn't do anything wrong. And
right.
Yeah. He had a way of doing that with other things that, you know, I'm trying to think of other examples, but that was the biggest one, like that, or, you know, the house example I gave him in the book as well. Like, oh, making sure nothing's out of place, because if there's like a thing out of place, like God forbid, like that would, you know, trigger something where all of a sudden, you know, well, maybe I'm not good enough.
Right. Well, you know, and as you were talking about testing boundaries, right, my whole life goes back to culture, social, goes back to movie references. Yeah. And I think here's the thing, the movie reference that I see is like Jurassic Park. And there's one Jurassic Park, I think it's one of the first ones, where they let them know, like, yeah, these velociraptors are always testing the fence. They test mm-hmm. it at every location all the time. They're testing their boundary. Mm-hmm. And that's a natural state for humans to go through. If you remember when you were a teenager, or if you have ever tried to raise a teenager or be around a teenager, right? This is very normal. That's that normal stage for them to test boundaries. And they test it, they test it, they test it. Some people don't mature past that. You know, through maturity, there are a lot of us that are like, I don't need to test your boundaries anymore, you know, because I'm going to take my responsibility and I'm going to let you take your responsibility for your life. And right, we're okay. Other people don't mature and are looking for those places. And I don't think it's a conscious thing. I think it's an unconscious behavior they have to look for those places that we can, oh, there's a boundary that's not going to be held. And they know they can take it just a little bit further.
Because we vulnerabilities in your
well, boundaries. And anytime we're developing a new relationship, we're always doing this boundary dance, right? But a lot of us do it with each other's consent and with communication, and then it's like, oh, okay, you have verbally told me that this is not okay in the relationship, or this is the level of professionalism that we're going to have in business, or whatever it is. And now I respect that boundary. Other people are like those velociraptors testing the fence, and test the fence all the time, looking for one little bit of weakness. And if that happens frequently as a human, we tend to start wearing out and tend to start, you know, moving those boundaries so that we just don't have to put up with that anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right, because it's like in a relationship where you love somebody, you know, there's this innate thing where you want, the hope is that you make, I don't say make someone happy, because you make yourself happy. You can't depend on someone else for your happiness. But, you know, I think in a mutual relationship, you just innately want to do things that, you know, make your relationship better and make, you know, do things that would bring happiness to that other person. And, you know, in some instances, in some relationships, that happens immediately, like in mine. And then over time, it's like, that's taken away. And, you know, but it's over time. And, but if you don't make a stink about it, or, and sometimes if you did bring it up in conversation, it's used against you, like all of a sudden, oh, now you're too needy, or you are asking too much. Like who do you think you are that you think that I have to do this for you all the time? Or, you know, and it's not even all the time, but it will be said in some way or fashion, indicating that you are really asking too much of the other person, which in a relationship where you want, you know, to have that mutual happiness, I think it's important to note that if someone is saying something like that, that they're not necessarily looking up for your happiness.
Right. Yeah. And for yourself and for the other contributor endotypes that are out there, yes, you do have this tendency to think that you need to earn it or do more. But here's the thing, that self-talk that's in your head that's going, am I doing enough? What else could I do? Is really what that part is trying to help you to understand is this really for you to do right now? Is this really for you to do more here? And it's trying to ask that question so that you engage with this part of you that's engaged in protecting, to be able to go, no, I don't have to do more. Like, no. And to find the boundary and then to hold it. But very often we don't hear that part of us accurately.
I think the other thing to note too, is that in my relationship, I expected like sort of equal give and take. And when I would mention that, he would say things like, I've never met anybody that is such a, like a, you know, keeps track of every little thing. And well, I wasn't keeping track of every little thing, but the biggest thing was, is that I noticed that over time I was doing a lot more to try to enhance our relationship. Meanwhile, he was relaxing and taking a step back and doing very little to try to keep that going, and looking at it as almost like it was my sole responsibility to make him happy. Yeah. And now I think, you know, I want to make it clear too, that I don't regret anything that has happened to me in my life. Like, I don't ever even regret being married to this individual, or or even meeting him, because of the fact that I've met him. And I think is another, maybe part of my personality, is that I look at it as it gave me an opportunity to grow and actually understand more about myself. And, you know, I don't mean for this to sound like I'm talking bad about him, but I think it's really important for people to be aware of these things in their relationship, because it's important that, you know, that other person may not even understand what they're doing. They just do these things, you know, and that. Well,
and sometimes it's that. So here's one of my observations with the endotype formula, right? Is that let's say you have love on your protective side. We were just talking about that. It's connected mm-hmm. to this piece. If he has love also as a craving on his protective side, mm-hmm. you're craving love. He's craving a different kind of love or craves it differently than you are doing it. Mm-hmm. That may or may not be an ideal match as far as an endotype thing. So it's not even like that person can't go forward and have a better relationship in a different environment, right? It's not like, once an abuser, always an abuser. That's not necessarily always true. Mm-hmm. But in this relationship, there was abuse.
Yes. I think that's good to know because, you know, he could meet somebody else in this lifetime where they are perfectly fine with, you know, being the submissive partner all of the time.
Right.
And letting him be in charge of everything. And, you know, maybe that's part of my endotype is that, you know, I'm looking for somebody who's more on the same wavelength as a partner, like an equal give and take, like an equal partnership, not like a power over partnership where somebody wants me to be a submissive partner, because that would not be a good match. You know, and that's the other thing I thought you brought up that was a really good point was about, you know, the perception of things being different. And I just remember one time he said, why can't you just be vulnerable? But our ideas of vulnerability were completely different. So in my mind, vulnerability is like having this conversation, talking openly about feelings or, you know, processes and, you know, how to make things better or, you know, noting things in the relationship that maybe aren't going so well and being able to talk about those things and make them better. And in his mind, vulnerability was me being completely broken. So it was chilling to me. Because that was a shock to me because of the fact that, you know, when I was like crying and just about to give up on a relationship and just like, I've had it, I can't do this. He's like, now he's being nice and being like loving and my brokenness is what he was craving, which was very, I remember processing that in my mind and thinking that is not vulnerability. That is having complete power over somebody else. And that is not right.
Right. And it's like, right. You need to save your own dang self. So, sometimes people have kind of, I was talking with somebody else about this, about identifying ourselves in certain roles. So the example that I was talking about is if we identify ourselves as strong, independent women, it's very hard to be in a relationship where we can fully rely on the other person because I'm independent. Mm-hmm. So, right. So we may need to change the definition of ourselves, but if somebody has always been the protector savior, mm-hmm. right. And he's going to save you from something. If you're not a little bit broken, what's his role? He can't save. He can't, right? So I can see where that may be some of the ways that he was identifying himself and why vulnerability to him felt like when you need me to save you, now I have a purpose.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I don't really know.
I don't either.
I don't know him and I don't know his endotype, but that's, it was just an interesting thought that came through there. Yeah. So, a contributor endotype can sometimes struggle to trust their intuition, believe they're smart enough, or make choices. And I think we've seen that a little bit. But how has that been a struggle for you? And perhaps even how have you learned to trust it more or learned to value intuition more?
So in my life, I think, you know, it depends on who you're surrounded by. You know, people who encourage you to try new things or do something more and to testing your boundaries, but like, you know, in terms of doing new things and pushing yourself to grow, I think I sort of did that myself growing up because my parents were, you know, my dad worked in a factory growing up and my mom worked for, you know, the state of Wisconsin doing something else. And so, you know, they both had their, you know, they worked and they had this idea that you need to just, you know, go to school, get a good job, you know, and retire. Like, that's what they were okay with. But in my mind, like, there was so much more I wanted to do in life. And there are so many exciting things to do and try. And just that my personality is totally different than my parents in that aspect where, you know, growing up, I took it upon myself to try new things. And anytime I got the opportunity to do something new, I would take it that opportunity and jump on it and be like, I'm doing this. So, you know, friends would ask me to go do something. I'm like, please, can I go? Please, can I go? Like, can I do this? And I guess, you know, then as time progressed and I think relationships entered the picture, then like one of my first relationships was not a good relationship. And I started questioning like if I was good enough for stuff or I would want to try new things. And, you know, that boyfriend was like, well, why do you want to do that? And, you know, this is like confusing to me because I've always been somebody who's liked to try new things and somebody was trying to limit me. And I think over time, that's kind of happened on and off. And so I've trusted my intuition when I was really young and like really gone and do new things and growing and doing things, you know, my way. And, mm-hmm. And then over time, like we're kind of taught, you know, and maybe as women in general, like we just are taught that, well, maybe you shouldn't think so big, or maybe you shouldn't do so much, you know, that's, you know, how are you going to do this? Or how are you going to do that? And people want you to be realistic. And I think I lost sight of that for a little while, but then after my divorce, I've really jumped back into listening to my intuition again. And it's felt really good because it's been such a long time. And now I'm still trying new things, doing new stuff, encouraging my kid to do new stuff. And it's so frustrating to me when she doesn't, but I understand she's her own person, but I'm like, oh my gosh, you have this great opportunity. Just take it. And I don't push too hard, but you know, I let her make her own decisions about that stuff, but I'm just like, oh God, you know, but she's not me. Mm-hmm. So I do understand.
Right. Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. She's got to follow her intuition too. That's beautiful. So one of the things that we've been talking about relationships, you were talking just a little bit ago about your first relationship and in relationships, right? One of the cravings is for belonging. We crave relationships in our life because we want to know where we belong. Who is our family? Who is our community? And the hero part of your endotype helps other people feel like they belong. And you can talk a little bit about how you do that. But it also is the same part of you that kind of struggles to self-apply, right? Struggles to feel like, or to choose places where you belong. And it needs to be trained. It makes that hero's journey of from not belonging into belonging. So how have you helped others feel like they belong, but also then trained belonging so that you get to belong too?
So I think, you know, when I was younger, I struggled a little bit because I'm a pretty deep thinker and I like to delve into the deeper meaning of things. And I never understood how like not everybody was like that. And that's, I think, where that belonging piece comes in, is that over time, I've just had to just come to terms with the fact that a lot of people are very topical and don't really want to delve very deeply into subject matter or ideas and things like that. So, you know, it's hard sometimes, but it's just something that I just understand now, and I don't push anything. And if, you know, I'll sort of test things to see where people are, but if they don't really bite, then I'm like, okay, well, we'll just keep it light and topical. It's okay. So I've really had to kind of like, gauge people in different personalities to see exactly where they are in the depth of their personalities. And that's something I continue to do, but I don't get discouraged anymore because I feel like, well, when I do happen to talk to that one person, and I think that it's just maybe, you know, I've just got a rare personality type or an openness to talk about that stuff with new people. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, some people are deeper once you get to know them more, you know, but for me, I think that it's just having an understanding now that, well, it's not that I'm lonely or anything like that, but it does get lonely sometimes when you can't express yourself the way you would really love to sometimes, but I don't know, I guess I have this understanding and I'm not depressed about it because I do understand that there are just a lot of people who don't like to dig for like the meaning of life or anything like that.
Right. And that's that intuitive part of you at your young child essence is that part that likes deep things. And I see it. I have a son who's the same endotype as you. He likes like thought-provoking movies and films, even though he's still very young and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't necessarily, and he's a boy. I think that boys, my observation is boys don't necessarily like to talk about as deep of things as girls do, especially at this younger age. But that's that. So your young child essence is the part that wants to use this intuition, wants to go deep and talk about ideas and things. And you, when you find the people that you can, pull them into that belonging with you.
Yeah.
But I know you also use your skills of belonging to be able to impact your community too. You know, and improving your community and the place where you live and helping with that as well.
Yeah. One thing I thought about too, is that how I encourage other people is that I love to hear what people are passionate about. And that excites me when I hear somebody talking about what they're excited about, or it doesn't even matter what the subject is or what it is about. It could be some really complex theory and I will still absorb every word and just, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. And someone will say, oh, I bet you're being bored to death. And I'm like, no, absolutely not. Keep going. And I really love hearing what people are passionate about. And it really doesn't matter what it is. If you're passionate about it, I love hearing about it. So like one example would be recently, there is a gentleman who is part of this historical society in our city. And like, just listening to talk about like historical sites with such passion made me want to just go out and like visit all of these sites. And I'm like, I was never into like historical stuff, but this makes me want to be into historical stuff because this guy is so passionate about it. And it was just, I get addicted to other people's excitement. So I think that's like a part of my personality is that, you know, when someone's excited, like I'm excited too for them. And I always want people to believe in themselves. That's a part of me too, is that there are things that I've tried and done, like, for example, like running for city council, you know, when that's one part of me impacting my community. And I'm really passionate about that too. I love helping people. I love it when people call me and talk about stuff, even if they're yelling at me. And I say that with in the nicest way possible, like they don't yell at me like in an abusive way, but like they, you know, want to talk about some issues they're having. And I like being able to help them solve those problems or connect them with someone who can help, and like being that conduit where, you know, it's between like the link between the city staff and the, you know, our constituents. So it's something I really love doing. And then I also love seeing projects put in motion that I've helped, you know, vote on to move forward. And that affects our community too. People may not always agree with how the community is moving forward, but I'm always happy to have those conversations with people. And I really love doing this. And I think there's some people that, you know, want a position of power for just the power. And for me, it is strictly about helping people and making a difference in my community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And that's just part of your endotype. The other genius part of your, the contributor endotype is worth. So helping people feel valued, feel good enough, feel valuable. How do you use this in your life? How have you seen yourself using that with others?
I try to be cognizant of what people are doing and making sure I'm paying attention to that. So for example, when I ask my daughter to do the dishes, when she does it, I'll, you know, even though that's something I've already asked her to do and she's supposed to do it, I still thank her. I go out of my way to make sure that she, you know, she knows that I appreciate that she did that, because everyone has a need to be appreciated and loved. And I think it's really important to go out of your way to thank people when they do nice things for you. So that's one way that I do that. So even in my regular, I also have a job that I work, you know, with medical supplies and things like that. And our customer service team is a really big part of, you know, how I end up making quota at the end of the month. So if they didn't do what they do, I wouldn't be successful either. So I always make sure to thank them if they go out of their way to do something for me, or if I have someone on the phone, I'm like, hey, by the way, I just want you to know that I appreciate you. Like, I don't know what I would do without you. You know, you have helped me with so many things, and I just want you to know that. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe it makes people feel embarrassed, you know, if they're not, not used to someone thanking them like that, but I thank them in emails and, you know, make sure that people know that they are appreciated, because I feel like that's so important, not only in your personal life, but in your professional life as well.
Right. And there are over half the endotypes. So, you know, 8 of the 16 have worth on the protective side, which is a craving for them. Mm-hmm. So they're running around never quite feeling good enough, never quite feeling like they can create or do, or, and so to have, you know, somebody whose genius it is, but I think to just bring it into awareness that for the people in our life, right, if we notice that these either words or actions of appreciation of value really light them up, rain that on them, mm-hmm. right? You know, because it's an innate craving that they have that that we can then help supply for them and help balance out, make their life just a little bit better, a little bit easier. And it's not super hard.
No, I was actually just the other day this happened. I was at a store, it was actually Walmart, and there's a lady who was in checkout. There was no one behind us, and she was just making small talk, and she mentioned how, you know, that wasn't her full-time job, that she just had fallen on hard times, and, you know, she had an interview and that she was a graphic designer. And I listened to every word that she said. And I said, oh my gosh, I hope your interview goes really well, you know, good luck. You know, I've been in a situation where I've lost a job too. And it's a very demeaning situation. So please, like, don't feel like this is going to last forever. You know, I just want you to have hope, because I can see that you're really excited about this interview, and I think that'll go a long way. And, you know, this is a complete stranger, and I just felt like just having someone listen to her, especially just with, you know, the pandemic and all of the isolation that people have experienced, that, you know, it really made her day. And, you know, when we ended our conversation, she's like, you know, thank you so much for listening. I'm sorry if I just, you know, kind of just gave you all the info there, but, and I said, hey, you know, don't worry about it. It's okay. I'm like, we're human. Like, you know, you're a human being. I'm a human being. Like, it was good to share that moment with you. So, you know, good luck. I wish you the best. And, you know, she's going to think about that for a long time. And I hope that, you know, she does really good on her interview. And I sincerely mean that, because I think that we need more of that kindness in the world, you know, where mm-hmm. you just a complete stranger, you never know like where they're at in the world, and they could really use some uplifting words.
Yeah, absolutely. We all crave that connection in one way or another, whether that's worth or whether that's that heart connection, craving belonging, whatever it is, we want connection. So, well, I think this was awesome. Thank you very much. I want to thank you for sharing your story in the book and being very vulnerable and sharing here. What's kind of next for you? What are you up to these days?
I saw that question, I'll be honest, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Well, right now I'm kind of busy with my campaigning. But you know, after this re-election stuff is over, I'm simultaneously teaching my niece how to drive. So there's
ooh, that. Teenagerly driving. Well, yeah. Our thoughts are always with you.
She's doing actually really well.
Good.
And I give her lots of good tips and that she always appreciates, I'm sure. but yeah, other than that, I don't know. I look forward to more adventure in my life and traveling and camping and hiking. And it would be great to see the Grand Canyon at some point, and Montana. I've always wanted to go there and see Glacier National Park. And yeah, I guess just relax more. But then there's also this you know, since I've done a writing project already, there's this fictional project that's been floating around in my brain that I should really put on paper. So at some point I need to really do a brain dump and get that out and just get started. I have it started. So I just need to continue working on that. But once awesome. Things slow down a little bit, hopefully I can start working on that again.
Very cool. And if people want to connect with you, how can they do so?
I did set up a new Gmail address. So it's just keelymywalk@gmail.com.
Perfect. And we'll put the link in the show notes also. And so people can just look there and access that. Again, you know, thanks for sharing vulnerably the story. I know it's not always an easy story to share, but it is important. These are important conversations that we need to bring out and we need to light up so that people know they're not alone in the circumstances that they are. So I appreciate it.
I agree. And thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today on this episode of My Walk, My Way. To not miss an episode, please go to wherever you get your podcasts and hit that subscribe button. While you're there, it really helps us out a lot if you leave a review. To pick up a copy of the My Walk My Way book, you can get that wherever books are sold and order that. And on our mywalkmyway.com website, you can find special gifts that help you understand your endotype just a little bit better. I can't go today before I give special thanks to the band Gin, Chocolate, and Bottle Rockets for allowing us to use this beautiful music from their song Shine. Check them out. The rest of their music is great too. Love to make my shine.